All right. Jimmy, are you there?
I'm here, yes.
Okay. Dave, you're there?
I am here.
All right.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it, Lauren.
Absolutely.
And a big aloha and mahalo, Brother Jimmy. Welcome back. It's been a long time, man.
Aloha.
Good to have you back on the show with us. And can you hear me okay on your end?
Yeah, I'm hearing you good. Are you hearing me okay?
I hear you great. Sounds like a real clear signal. There's a tiny bit of delay, so I'll always pause. I'll always wait till you're finished talking, because it sounds like we've got, you know, we're continents away from each other. But no, it sounds really clear. And I really appreciate you taking time to do this for us here in Hawaii. It means a lot.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So prior to The Harder They Come, I wanted to sort of set the scene. We're talking about this incredible The Harder They Come Collector's Edition dropping now. And just to give some context on it, you'd already been releasing singles for a decade, albums for a number of years as well. If you can, set the stage. At the time that you first heard the offer to do the film, where were you living? And explain sort of where your career was at, having already signed to Island Records and, I believe, leaving Jamaica to live in the United Kingdom.
Correct. Now, I was living in the UK at the time, in London. And I had a number of hits. Wonderful World, Beautiful People, Wild World, Vietnam, and a few other hits. So I was doing fantastic all over Europe. And I kind of hesitated before I accepted that role, because I know I could have made a lot of money. I was doing really good.
And so you explain a little bit, too, for folks who don't know the story, why you had ended up moving to England.
Yeah, I would lose a lot of money because I said I had, like, I had Wild World was in the top 10 or top 5 somewhere there. And I was just coming off Wonderful World, Beautiful People. And when you have two consecutive huge hits like that, it means you can work all over Europe and make a bunch of money.
I get it. So it was an economic incentive to be based there, because that's where you were having success. So it made total sense to be located there. And many people who are your fans in the United States and Hawaii may not know that you had already appeared long ago in America, from what I researched, having been at the World's Fair in New York back in 1964. And to put that in context, that was the same year the Supremes had their breakthrough hit, Where Did Our Love Go?
Oh, that's right. That's right. I remember walking the streets of New York, and I couldn't stop hearing that song everywhere. I said, wow, what a song. Yes, I did appear at the World's Fair, and I got rave reviews. And there was another magazine called Cashbox, apart from Billboard. So I got rave reviews in those magazines.
Yeah, it's a great beginning for you. And did you, it's cool memory of hearing the song on the radio then. Did you see any American music acts at that time that helped shape your life?
Oh, yes. I went to the Apollo, the famous Apollo. I went to the Fox Theater in Brooklyn. So those were like points where mostly Black American acts, whenever you get a hit, you are destined to perform at one of those two places, or both. And the Apollo was a great place for everyone to perform. So I saw from James Brown to Sam and Dave to all the Motown acts. I saw everybody there, you know. The thing was, how it was back in the days was they did like four or five shows a day. So you could go in from 10 o'clock in the morning and come out like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the night. And I bought that all-day ticket, and I would stay and watch every one of them. Yes, so they were inspiring for me.
Those are great stories, and it gives a lot of context to The Harder They Come, because it's important to know what had come before that in your life. And I think for a lot of people, they don't realize there had been a lot of really incredible chapters like what you're just describing that helped to shape who you've turned out to be. And also in that same year, you were in a program called This Is Ska with Toots and the Maytals, Prince Buster, and others. Was that and forgive me for not knowing what it was it a filmed program, or what was that exactly?
Well, yeah, it was a film program, and I went to the States at that time to promote ska, because they were trying to break it through in America. And so that program was like a part of that.
And that's what you were calling your music at the time, ska?
It was ska, yes, because it was like upbeat, quite different from the slowed down rock steady, then into reggae, what was in between the two, not so fast, not so slow.
It's a fascinating evolution. And thinking about the parallel to this, which is critical to our discussion, had you done any acting yet? And if so, describe what you had done at that point.
The only acting I had done prior to that was in school. And, acting was really my first love. So in our school, every time there was a break for holiday, whether it be what you might call spring break, but that for us was, we didn't call it spring break, but it was about the same time period. And then there was the summer holidays, and then there was the Christmas holidays. We would have a play for the breaking up each time. I really look forward to that. Whether I got a lead part in it or I got a small part in it, I was outstanding. Because I loved what I was doing. I loved it.
Wow, that's really cool. So it really paints a picture of where your head was at the time when that offer finally came in, and also why you had some trepidation, too, because of all this success. And on that note, explain how you had gotten, because prior to The Harder They Come, you had also gotten signed to Island, which was an important thing, and I guess first meeting Chris Blackwell as part of that.
Okay. Well, I first met Chris Blackwell on the same trip to New York when I worked at the New York World's Fair. He came to me, and I was looking for him in Jamaica. I couldn't find him. But after that performance, and he read the reviews, he came to me and he said, introduced himself and said, you know, I would like to take you to England. And I said, no, I don't want to come to England. He said, you can stay here in America. There are many like you, but in England, there is none like you. And look what I have done for Millie Small. And I think you are far better than Millie Small. And with all that convincing, I still took 3 months and went back to Jamaica before I decided. And I say, you know, I wrote him and I say, okay, I'll come. I'm ready to come. And that was the story. I went to the UK and it was a great decision I made to go there.
And boy, what a different time, too. You wrote him, huh? Like an actual letter that you would mail to him. How much the technology has changed, huh, in between now and then?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And on that, it's a great transition. So this is just in the handful of years prior to this incredible film coming out. And in that period in the UK, you'd done some interesting covers in the late 60s. Procol Harum's Whiter Shade of Pale, Dave Mason's Can't Stop Worrying among them. Was that the record label's idea to have you kind of do that to get some success? Or was that your own being influenced by being there?
Well, you see, Chris Blackwell was my manager. He wasn't just my, I didn't just go to sign on to his record label. He was my manager. And he recommended those songs, and including another song, many other songs, you know, Can't Get Enough of It, and a song by Bobby Blue Bland, and many of those songs. He recommended them, and I kind of liked them, you know, so I went along with it.
just as interesting in your sound and development in these critical years that precede The Harder They Come. One of the other very UK, to me at least, it has a very UK sound to it from the late 60s, the song Waterfall. In how would you describe today, looking back in musical terms, the sound you had on those records, Hard Road to Travel, and that Jimmy Cliff self-titled album, which would be renamed Wonderful World, Beautiful People?
Oh, the music has evolved so much from today. You know, the sound in the UK at the time was the sound of like waterfall, and well, you know, you're in the environment, so you adapt to the environment and go along with the sound that was going. Today, it's a far different thing. You know, the music has evolved to what it is today. The reggae sound is far different from that. What I used to do then, back then, but it wasn't even reggae, you know.
Yeah, it's an incredible journey. And as we now, we're really right there before The Harder They Come. And there's a song that comes before that movie and that soundtrack that is a really important one. So when you think about that, there's Wild World and Another Cycle. There's important tracks that factor into the film that come from some of these records. And one of them is The Bigger They Come. Can you explain the idea to re-record and remake that song, which would end up being the critical song for this movie?
Okay, well, I was in Argentina at the time. I left Brazil. I went to Argentina. I was in Argentina for just over 3 months, and I learned to speak Spanish there, just picking it up. And I met this this guy called Gilly Bright, and we just met on the street. And he said, "Hey, how are you?" I said, "Because you know, as a black person, when you see another black person in Argentina, you know, it's predominantly, you know, Caucasian people." He said, "Hey," I said, "Hey, what did you do? I'm a singer." He said, "Yeah, you singer. I'm a writer. Hey, let's get together and have a drink or so." So I said, "I'm staying at this hotel." So he came over and I started playing him my songs. He said, "Wow, you got some nice songs there." And I started playing him some of the half-finished ones. And I say, "This one," and I play you this one. He says, "This one is called The Harder They Come." He said, "Wow, that's a great song. Why don't you play it like The Bigger They Come, The Harder They Fall?" I said, "Wow, that sounds good." So we just went along, changed the lyrics. I already had the melody and the chord progression and everything. And we changed it to that. And we went to Muscle Shoals in Alabama and recorded that.
It's incredible. It's a huge evolution in one of the critical songs of it. And then, so we have arrived at the point where you're invited to do the film. You decide to sign on with some trepidation because you've established yourself. You're happening. Things are going good for you. And then explain the story. Are you get a contract? What is it? You're going to travel back to Jamaica to film. And had you been away from Jamaica for a while, or were you making periodic visits?
Wonderful. Okay, now I had been back to Jamaica periodically because that's where I recorded Wonderful World, Beautiful People. That's where I recorded You Can Get It If You Really Want. So I kept going, you know, periodically. Now, when Perry Enzo said to me, "Why are you refusing to do this movie? It's about Ivan." And he didn't say Ivan, he said about Reagan. And I knew of Reagan as a child, and he was like an awesome name. If somebody said Reagan is coming, you better hide. Because for a person in that time to have guns, and moreover, to shoot a policeman, it was unheard of. So I said, "Okay, this Reagan, I know I had this rebel side of me." I say, "Wow, it's appealing. But why should I come?" Perry Enzo said to me, "I think you're a better actor than singer." And I went silent because I felt the same way. I said, "No, you got me." I said, okay, I'll do the movie. And we run a few scenes. We run the scene with the mother, where I came from the country.
Right.
And I came and I met my mother and all of that. And after I run the scene, he played the mother. I played Ivan. And he said, this is the man I've been looking for all these years to do my movie.
Wow.
I didn't believe him because I thought, well, you know, I'm doing well. I'm a big star in Europe now and not in America too. And you want somebody to push your movie. And that's why you want me. But when he said, you are, I think you're a better actor than singer. I said, no way you could know that. I never said that to anyone. So that convinced me, and I went to Jamaica and made a song. But prior to going there, I recorded Wonderful World, Beautiful People. And I, on that same trip to make all of that session, I came to New York to mix them. And that's where I recorded Many Rivers to Cross.
Wow. It's nice to hear that evolution. That's an incredible story. That's one of the great things about talking to you. I've done a few other interviews. You're just a wonderful storyteller. It's such a gift. A lot of people have great, great stories. It's hard to tell them. So you really do have a, and maybe that's why you wanted to be an actor so much, because that's a real important part of being an actor. And you know what else?
Yes.
You told me another funny thing in a previous interview about the production of The Harder They Come. And again, we're talking with the great Jimmy Cliff about the Harder They Come Collector's Edition, which is just dropping now. You had told me that it was such a simple production that it was often just one camera that they were using?
One camera right through. And about three-quarters of the way through, the one cameraman that we were using from the UK, he was riding the same bicycle that I was riding in the movie, and he fell down and busted his face.
Ooh.
So we had to get another cameraman. Well, he recovered in about 2 to 3 weeks. And so from there on, we had two cameras.
Wow. That's amazing. What an organic production, huh? And to think of the impact this thing has had and using such simple technology. And also, when you talk about him and that and the scene, paint a picture of, like, to the people on the set, were you a big star to them? Were they really kind of looking up to you as somebody who had made it out of Jamaica and then was back as like this sort of a hero?
Kind of, to a good degree. To some of them, like to the cameraman, no. The cameraman from the UK, no. But to some of the other Jamaicans, such as Elsa, the girl who was Preacher's girlfriend, and I took Preacher's girlfriend, you know, she was a budding actress in Jamaica, and to her, yeah, I was a big star, you know, big name. So, yeah, to some of the people on the set, yes, I was.
And the recording culture of Jamaica that you experienced yourself prior to that, in some ways, getting into the business in the earliest years, was it similar to what is portrayed in the film?
Well, great question, because when Perry wrote the scenes of which we're going to shoot daily, he would sometimes say, Jimmy, forget about that. How would you do it? Forget about the script that you wrote for that day for the scene. He said, how would you do it? And I just drew back on my experiences, such as like the studio scene. I know that very well, my first recording, and I got a little bit of money for my second recording. My first recording, I didn't get any money. You know, it was just sound system owner. And he said, hey, little schoolboy, how come you want money? As you make a record, you want money. Anyway, here's a shilling. Take a bus fare. So, Yeah, I just draw back on a lot of the scenes. And I went to all the producers in Kingston, and I got turned down. One who was a new producer coming in, that was my second recording. Well, I recorded with him, but that song didn't hit. Until I went to Beverly's Records. And one night, I'll give you the story short. I was walking down Horan Street, one of the main streets in Kingston. And I saw a sign, Mark Beverly's Records. And wow, a bulb went off in my head. I was had this little unfinished song called Dearest Beverly. I said, wow, if I finish this song, maybe they would let me in. And I finished the song in 5 minutes. So they were closing. I put my foot in the door. And he said, we're closed. I said, I have a song. He said, we don't do recording. That was the caretaker. He said, we don't do recording. But I said, you can do it. He can do it. I said, we're closed. So anyway, the three brothers who were Chinese heard, and they said, who is it? They said, a little boy, same up song, and they said, you know. And I'm running him, and he won't leave. And Leslie Kong said, let him in. And I went in with a big, broad smile on my face. And then the two other brothers, they laughed. I said, I have a song. I can sing. He said, what's the name of the song? I said, Dearest Beverly. He said, let me hear it. And I start singing, my dearest Beverly, please come home and let me be happy once more. You've been away so long. And all because I done you wrong. It was just, as you can hear, it's a ballad, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, Leslie Kong look at me and he said, you have the best voice I ever heard in Jamaica. And to myself, I said, yes! Because I believe that about myself. So, it was those kind of things, you know? And just I gave you the story of like a earlier part before the harder they come, so I kind of jump chapters there. But we come back to the harder they come, and
well,
that's how we did some of the scenes, you know.
That's a great part, though. You just told a story that answered the question that I had, which was the movie features a very brief appearance by Leslie Kong, who, as you described, in 61, heard you singing that song outside the restaurant ice cream parlor in Kingston, and it would start both your recording career, but also it would start his record label, true? And then he shows up in the movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Start him off as a... And he became King Kong after that.
Right.
He was known as King Kong.
Right. No.
Because of all the other Jamaican African producers, he was the first Chinaman to enter the business. And what is Chinaman doing in the business? He don't know nothing about the music, but he became the one who put most of the Jamaican hits in the British charts and in the American charts. Bob Marley came to Leslie Kong via me, via Desmond Dekker, and I auditioned his first three songs. So Leslie Kong became the real King Kong. Bob Marley's career started with Leslie Kong via me.
You auditioned his first three songs to Leslie, is that correct?
I auditioned them. And I called Leslie Kong. I said, the story goes like this. There was Desmond Dekker who came down. I auditioned him. He recorded this song. Bob and Desmond were welders. And Desmond went back and told Bob, you know, I met this guy, Jimmy Keefe, and I got the song recorded. So he sent Bob down. And I was there one day playing the piano. And Bob just walked up behind me and said, that song good enough. And I looked around. I said, who could this be saying that song? Because I knew what I was playing. It sounded good. And he said, yeah, me and Bob, you know. And I said, okay, well, go on. And he said, well, this man sent me down here and me have some songs. And so He said, sing them. And I played the piano. He started singing. I played the piano. He sang about 5 songs, and I chose 3 of them. And I called Leslie Kahn, and I said, you know, listen to these songs. Well, Leslie Kahn wasn't impressed with Bob Marley's voice. He said, sure, can't sing much. But he was impressed with his lyrics.
Mm.
And so that was the story. But that was the story of Leslie Kahn. So, you know, I drew back on some of those experiences from Leslie Kahn that same night. And that's how I did, like, the first scene in the studio, you know. And so I give you all of those stories to come up to the point.
Yeah, it's like and it makes a lot of sense. These are the things that explain how you were able to do the movie with such conviction, because you had experienced so many of these things yourself and were able to lend that authenticity to it. And when you talk about Leslie Kahn factoring in as an important sort of cameo, if you will, in a way, in the movie, there's another interesting one. I don't know if a lot of your fans know unless they've researched it, but one of the castmates in the film The Harder They Come, Beverly Anderson, would go on to marry Michael Manley, who became Prime Minister of Jamaica.
Oh yes. And there's a little story about Beverly myself. I liked her. She was a beautiful woman. And Terry Enzo said, you know, take your eyes off her. She's Manley's woman. well, okay, all right. I'll step aside.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That is very, very funny. And at that time, just to be clear, was the film still, when you were offered the film, was it called Ragin, after Ivanhoe Martin?
Oh, he wrote the script as Ragin. And then we changed the title along the way to Hard Road to Travel. And then somewhere in the middle of the film, we start to discuss and say, he said, I want you to record a song, write a song for it. And I said, well, I don't know, what kind of song? He said, well, you know, the guy's saying, he's saying, the harder they come, the harder they fall. You know, this guy, his character is like that. And boom, light went off in my head. And that same night, I wrote the song. Played it to him, unfinished, the next day. And he said, yeah, that's it. And we kind of recorded it in the movie like that.
So it was essentially, you had already had the song as The Bigger They Come, and you explained the story of writing that, and so then it was suggested to you by somebody else that the movie had this refrain and that you should just use that song?
Oh, well, look, the Bigger They Come, I already had the melody and everything. And, well, yes, we recorded that in Muscle Shoals. And then we recorded it in
Jamaica.
But it was in Jamaica. But when I recorded it in Muscle Shoals, you know, as I told you, I had the song and I was singing it to Gilly Bright. And, you know, he said, well, you know, let's do it that way. So The Harder They Come was not recorded yet. The Bigger They Come was recorded.
But I'm saying, so when you were doing the movie, it occurred to you, wait a minute, I could change my song, The Bigger They Come, and make it The Harder They Come. And that was sort of the moment that it happened?
Oh, let me tell you how it went. I wrote the song while I was doing the movie. And one of the times when they ran out of money, there was a long break. I went back to England. And Chris said, Chris Blackwell said, why don't you write a kind of a rhythmic song? Do you hear something like Santana? And I say, yeah, Santana. Okay, well, rhythmic. I can write something rhythmic. That is, you know, not exactly reggae. And so I wrote a song called Sitting in Limbo. And he said, okay, let's go to Muscle Shoals and record that. And I went just to record that song, but we ended up doing a whole album. And so that's how I come to record The Bigger They Come, which was already written in Jamaica. But the scene with me singing it in the movie was not done as yet. So the song was not recorded in Jamaica yet. So the first recording of it was as The Bigger They Come.
It's incredible the evolution and how big that song would end up going as it changed. And you had talked about the very interesting facet of how everything was ska for a long time. And then by the time that you're there filming the movie itself, so it's like 71, 72, I guess. Were you calling it reggae by then? Were you establishing, like, were you thinking of yourself, I'm a reggae artist or I make reggae music? Where was that term reggae at that moment?
So we had come out of the era of ska. And now we're talking about, we filmed the movie 1970, you know. And so we come out of the era of ska. So now we were into rock steady and reggae. So at that time, it had evolved to reggae. Yes.
Wow. Okay. So that was what it was finally called. And then you, the soundtrack itself, were you the producer of the soundtrack at the time? And talk about how the choosing of those songs went. Because there are some other, as you know, and maybe people listening may not, there are some critical songs in there other than Jimmy that are really cool and part of the movie.
Yeah. So how that the soundtrack came about, I had the song Sitting in Limbo, I came back with it. I played it to Perry, and so he liked it. But all this time, we still hadn't got a soundtrack. While the movie's almost finished, and we haven't got a soundtrack yet. And the movie was finished. And, you know, practically finished, and no soundtrack. So Perry said, what are we going to do about a soundtrack? I said, well, you know, I have this song Sitting in Limbo, and so on. And so I think, if I remember right, Perry got together with Chris Blackwell, but Perry was the main one who picked most of the songs that were already hits in Jamaica, like Draw Your Brakes, Rivers of Babylon, and all of these songs. But my songs, like Many Rivers to Cross, was like already recorded, which I told you that story. And You Can Get It If You Really Want was already recorded. And so he just picked a bunch of songs from songs that were already recorded, including some of mine. So the only song that was written for the movie was The Harder They Come.
And no Bob songs factor in there, which is interesting too, because as you had already pointed out in a previous story you generously told us today, Bob had already been producing songs for a long time at that point.
But Bob had not...
He hadn't broken yet.
No, he hadn't broken yet. I mean, he had some songs. Yeah, he broke some hit songs on sound systems, like Simmer Down and lots of those songs. But he hadn't broken yet. So after The Harder They Come is when Bob really broke out. How? Well, he was talented. I saw his talent as a writer. And... And he had his unique sound. But after the album came out, that was when Chris Blackwell or Island Records and I parted company. And he got Bob Marley and said, I'm going to show you. And he promoted Bob Marley. And so that's how it went. So Bob Marley was not... He didn't have any songs that could have gone in the movie, I don't think, because Perry didn't choose any of his songs, but he has ska songs. And a few rocksteady songs, I think, like Dopey Conqueror, songs like that. But I guess there weren't songs that Perry wanted because he picked most of the songs.
And as we wrap it up with you, because you brought us right to that point, and I mean, the film comes out, And the question, I guess, would be, how did The Harder They Come change your career? And you kind of just mentioned a little bit of that, which I've never heard much about, which is, if I read you right, you and Chris Blackwell parted ways after this, is how you described it?
Right. Yeah, we parted ways because I felt all these years I was there and no attention was being paid to me, because during that time I also produced hit songs for Desmond Dekker, and like You Can Get It If You Really Want was a hit for Desmond Dekker before, but I produced that along with Leslie Kahn. And also another song called Let Your Year Be Ye. I got another group from Jamaica, The Pioneers, and put them in that. So they all became top five hits. So I was like a singer, songwriter, producer, and actor. Now I'm an actor. And, well, I just felt like I wanted to, it was time for me to leave. That's the way I felt, because it's my break now. The Harder They Come came out, and it was big buzz all over the place. And I felt like it was time for me to leave, and Chris felt, you left at the wrong time, because I was looking for the right vehicle to promote you, and now I have the vehicle, and you leave. You were to leave when I got the vehicle to promote you. And I felt, well, I don't know about that, because I was here all of these years and I was doing things. I had wonderful, world, beautiful people. I was a producer and making hits and that. And I didn't get the attention I felt I should deserve, as all the other artists on the roster on Island Records. So we had a disagreement of a vision. So, yeah, like I just say, we parted company in that way. But now we're good friends.
And your career just took off like a rocket anyway, even as you parted ways, correct?
Right. Well, see, yeah, The Harder They Come really catapulted me to another level, because now I am an actor and singer and songwriter and all of that. And, yeah, that's it catapulted me and catapulted the music of Jamaica along with it, because the movie, you know, showed people and a new culture, a new music, and all of that, yeah. And that movie was such a impact, even on Hollywood, that the movie Scarface is a takeoff of The Harder They Come, in my view, okay?
Right,
and a few other people's view. Because if you look at Scarface, the character that... I forget his name.
Al Pacino?
Coming from Cuba. Al Pacino. He came from Cuba. And, you know, he came to the big city, want to make it. You know, and me, country boy, came to town, came to city, want to make it and that. He got involved in drugs and that. And, you know, want to get it to the top. You know, the same kind of thing. It's a takeoff of the same movie. So, you know, The Harder They Come had an impact in so many ways, not only in music, but also in film.
That is a great analogy, too. And I think, I don't remember the ending of Scarface, but I know the ending of The Harder They Come has that really abrupt ending in the movie. And I just am, I know some people don't like movies to end like that. I love when they end with a strange sort of like, bam, and it just ends. So I always, that's a great...
Well, Scarface ended with... him shooting it out with you know, saying, say hello to my new friend.
Right, right, right. Yeah, and it was sort of, I guess,
it, like that.
It was sort of an abrupt ending there, too, I guess.
absolutely. So, you know, yeah, The Harder They Come was a masterpiece and a landmark in music and film industry.
It is the great Jimmy Cliff, who has been so generous to take time with us today to be back on the show. He was last on with us. You were here, I think it was 2011 or 2012 that you played in the islands. We did a phoner. We did an in-person thing when you at the venue. We had a really nice time. And so, as we've been talking about The Harder They Come Collector's Edition, which is dropping now and available for folks. I give you a huge hug. I give you a huge high five, and I thank you so much. I hope that you had as much fun today talking as I did, my brother.
I certainly did, my brother, and, you know, more life and more strength and all of that to you. Blessed love to everyone. This is Jimmy Cliff. It was a great thrill to be back on the air with my friend Dave Lawrence.